Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with the program called As It Is. We come to you 7 days a week with interesting and important stories from around the world. We always present our stories at a slightly slower speed, and we use a limited vocabulary. That means we use fewer words that are easy to understand. Today we have two items for you. The first examines problems between two of Africa's largest economies. Then, another look at the drug problem in Asia. This time, the Internet is involved. That's what we have lined up for you today from VOA. Let's get started. Nigeria and South Africa are no strangers to diplomatic disputes. Recently, the Nigerian government told its top diplomats in the South African capital to return home after a series of attacks on foreigners in South Africa. The South African government has sharply criticized the Nigerian action. Many South African officials have criticized the attacks on African immigrants. At least 7 people have died in the violence. Thousands of others were forced from their homes. The governments of 3 African countries helped hundreds of their citizens to leave South Africa after the unrest. The 3 countries are Malawi, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe. But the Nigerian government was the first in Africa to withdraw its top diplomats from South Africa. Nigeria's government says it did not officially order the diplomats to return home. It says they were asked to return to Nigeria for routine discussions. But that has done little to stop the sharp disputes between Nigeria and South Africa. This week, the South African Foreign Ministry released a statement noting Nigeria's failure to stop Boko Haram militants. The statement noted that thousands of people have died in the militants' campaign of violence against the Nigerian government. The South African Foreign Ministry also criticized Nigeria's actions after a church hostel collapsed in Lagos last year. The building collapse killed 84 South Africans. We did not blame the Nigerian government for the deaths and more than 9 months' delay in the return of the bodies, the ministry said. The diplomatic dispute demonstrates a complex relationship between Africa's 2 economic powers. Their open disagreement over who should head the African Union led to each country expelling the other's citizens in 2012. Those people were accused of using fake reproductions of yellow fever vaccination documents. Nigeria and South Africa also clashed over the South African science fiction film District 9. In the movie, Nigerians are treated like criminals and eat people. Nigerian government officials later banned the film. Nigerian officials are unhappy about the inclusion of South Africa in the BRICS group of developing countries. The group's other members are Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Nigerian officials also have objected to South Africa describing itself as the gateway to Africa. They note that Nigeria became the largest economy in Africa last year. Diplomatic relations between the 2 countries are cool, but business links have grown over the past 10 years. South African investments in Nigeria have risen 5 times between 2004 and 2010. Last week, Nigerians gathered near the offices of a South African telecommunications company to protest the attacks on foreigners. The protest took place in the city of Kaduna, outside the offices of MTN. One of the protesters, Yusuf Omoke, threatened to attack South African businesses in Nigeria.
If South Africans are not ashamed, if South Africans are not reasonable enough not to kill our people, not to destroy our businesses, then we Nigerians will also not be reasonable enough to leave their businesses to survive in Nigeria.
Shadrack Guto is a professor at the University of South Africa. He notes that both countries would very much like to be named to a permanent African seat on the United Nations Security Council. But the Council's current members have yet to approve such a seat. Professor Guto thinks relations between the two countries may improve after a change of presidents in Nigeria. You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Trafficking of synthetic or man-made drugs is growing across much of Southeast Asia. United Nations officials say the growth is being helped in part by rising demand and by use of the Internet. They want stronger controls on what they call precursor chemicals, those used to make synthetic drugs. Bob Doty has more on a recent conference held to discuss the problem.
The UN's Office on Drugs and Crime says drug production and trafficking is expanding in both East Asia and Southeast Asia. It also says the drug trade is diversifying, moving into new products outside international control. The agency says legal chemicals are being used in drug production. It says there is a growing need to stop that from happening. More than 200 government officials from 39 countries traveled to Bangkok for the conference, which was held this month. Jeremy Douglas is the agency's representative in Asia. He told the delegates the drug problem has worsened.
And it is important that this conference is here in Asia, where most of the precursor chemicals are produced, and where, as was pointed out, significant drug production is taking place. If we are to make headway on the drug production situation here and in other regions, we need to have effective international control.
Officials say Myanmar is the place where criminals produce the largest amount of synthetic drugs. The country is also known as Burma. The officials say traffickers bring precursor chemicals into Myanmar, then transport the drugs back across its mostly unguarded borders to markets in China, Thailand, and other countries. Thailand's justice minister spoke at the conference. Pai Boon Kumchaya said there appears to have been little progress in recent months to control precursor chemicals in Asia.
In the year 2013, we raised awareness of all the countries, but we have not come up with the clear measure yet of how the manufacturing countries, importing countries, and all the relevant parties, how are we going to control precursor chemicals effectively in our region?
UN law enforcement officials say there are hundreds of synthetic drugs known as new psychoactive substances. They noted that just 10 of these have been listed as controlled substances, meaning sales are restricted. And they say many criminal organizations sell drugs on the Internet. This creates a problem for law enforcement. Jeremy Douglas told VOA more Asian countries need to establish rules to control trafficking of precursor chemicals.
This is the heartland or the center point production. Asia is where the precursors are largely coming from.
Officials at the Bangkok meeting talked about developing an Asian policy for dealing with the problem. They also spoke about strengthening border security. The policy plans are being prepared for a UN General Assembly special session on the worldwide drug trafficking problem to be held next year. I'm Bob Doty.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. A policy dispute is taking shape in Washington over a government agency that helps exporters. On one side is the American business community. On the other side are conservative Republican Party lawmakers. Unless Congress takes action, the Export-Import Bank of the United States could be forced to stop accepting new customers at the end of June. W.S. Darley and Company is a 108-year-old family business. It makes fire trucks in the United States and sells them all over the world. The Export-Import Bank provides loans or other assistance to buyers of U.S. products. Peter Darley is Darley's chief executive officer.
And they can spread their payments out over period of time, makes it more affordable.
Business leaders and officials say small companies making products from pickles to ice cream have received help from the Export-Import Bank. The bank's supporters recently met in Washington. They say U.S. exports would slow without help from the government agency. And that, they say, would hurt economic growth. The Export-Import Bank also provides help to big companies. The aircraft maker Boeing receives help from the bank. Boeing says it would have to move some of its manufacturing jobs overseas without the help it receives. But Delta Airlines has a different opinion about the government agency. Delta says the bank has helped foreign customers buy airplanes from Boeing at a lower cost than it can. The airline company says that hurts its profits and U.S. aviation jobs. Delta's concerns are one reason for planned hearings next month in the U.S. Senate. This week, the House of Representatives Financial Services Committee held hearings. Texas Congressman Jeb Hensarling is a Republican and chairman of the committee. Before the hearing, he said big companies get the majority of the bank's assistance.
That the smarter and fairer way to promote American exports is by fundamental tax reform, strong trade agreements, a regulatory freeze with the exception of health and safety, and greater American energy independence with projects like the Keystone Pipeline.
But supporters argue that the Export-Import Bank provides important help when competing with government-supported foreign companies. The head of the bank, Fred Hochberg, says his agency helps both large and small U.S. businesses.
Companies come to us and they say we either have to meet the competition because foreign governments are supporting our competitors, or we're selling in a market that conventional financing is simply not available.
Fred Hochberg says he is hopeful the Export-Import Bank will survive. He notes that 60 nations, including China and India, have similar agencies to support their exports. And that's the VOA Learning English Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember with Shirley Griffith. This week in our series, we begin the story of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In 1932, Americans were tired of the policies of Republican President Herbert Hoover. They thought Hoover had done too little to fight the depression that was crushing the economy. They gave a big victory to Franklin Roosevelt and his Democrats in the elections that year. Roosevelt believed that the federal government should do more to help average Americans. The election brought hope to many Americans in the autumn of 1932. But Roosevelt did not become president until March of 1933, 4 months after the election. And those months saw the American economy fall to its lowest level in the history of the nation.
President Hoover tried to arrange a World Economic Conference, and he called on President-elect Roosevelt to join him in making conservative statements in support of business. Roosevelt refused. He did not think it was correct to begin acting like a president until he actually became the president. He did not want to tie himself to policies that the voters had just rejected. Congress, controlled by Democrats, also refused to help Hoover.
It was a strange period, a season of uncertainty and anger. The economy was worse than ever. The lines of people waiting for food were longer than before. Angry mobs of farmers were gathering in the countryside, and the politicians in Washington seemed unable to work together to end the crisis. Hoover said, "We are at the end of our rope. There is nothing more we can do." And across the country, Americans waited, worried, uncertain, afraid. What would the new president do?
The new president was 51 years old. His family name was well known to the American public. Theodore Roosevelt, a distant family member, had served as one of America's greatest presidents 30 years earlier. Franklin Roosevelt was born to a rich and important New York family. He went to the best schools, Groton, Harvard, and Columbia Law School. In 1910, he won election to the New York State Legislature. He showed great intelligence and political understanding as a state senator, and worked hard for other Democratic candidates. Franklin Roosevelt next served as Assistant Secretary of the Navy under President Woodrow Wilson. And in 1920, he was the Democratic Party's unsuccessful candidate for Vice President.
The next year, Roosevelt suffered a personal tragedy. He was sailing during a holiday with his family. Suddenly, his body became cold. He felt severe pain in his back and legs. Doctors came, but the pain got worse. For weeks, Roosevelt was forced to lie on his back. Finally, doctors discovered that Roosevelt was a victim of polio. He lost control of his legs because of the disease. He would never walk again. Roosevelt had always been an active man who loved sports.
But now he would have to live with a wheelchair. All of his money and fame could not get him back the strength in his legs.
Many Americans thought the illness would end Roosevelt's political dreams, but they were wrong. He showed an inner strength that people had never seen in him before. Roosevelt ran as the Democratic candidate for governor of New York State in 1928. He won by a small number of votes. 2 years later, the voters of New York re-elected Roosevelt, and they cheered his creative efforts to help citizens of the state who were suffering from the Great Depression.
Franklin Roosevelt always appeared strong and friendly in public. He loved to laugh and enjoy life. But his happy face hid a strong will. Throughout his life, Roosevelt worked to improve life for the common man. And he was willing to use the power of government to do this. He thought the government had the power and responsibility to improve the life of its citizens.
Roosevelt believed deeply in this, but he was less certain about the best way to do it. Above all, we must try something, he said, during the presidential campaign of 1932. Roosevelt believed that the country demanded creative experimentation. Americans in large numbers across the country voted for Roosevelt in 1932. They supported his calls for action to end the Depression. But no one was really sure just what this new president from New York, this man unable to walk, would really do after he entered the White House.
Inauguration Day in 1933 began with clouds and a dark sky. Roosevelt went to church in the morning, and then he drove with President Hoover from the White House to the Capitol, the building where Congress meets. Roosevelt tried to talk with Hoover as they drove, but Hoover said little. He just waved without emotion at the crowd. The two men arrived at the Capitol. A huge crowd of people waited. Millions more Americans listened to a radio broadcast of the ceremony. The Chief Justice of the United States, Charles Evans Hughes, gave the oath of office to Roosevelt. And then Americans waited to hear what the nation's 32nd president would say. He told them he was sure they expected him to speak openly and honestly about the situation facing the country. He told them that their great nation would survive as it had survived in the past, that it would recover and become rich again. He talked about the danger of fear, a nameless fear that blocked efforts to move forward. And he talked about Americans giving their support to honest, active leadership in every dark hour of their history. Here is some of Roosevelt's inaugural address in his own words.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
Roosevelt's words caught the emotions of the crowd. He seemed sure of himself. He promised leadership. His whole style was different from the empty promises of wealth offered by President Hoover.
Happiness lies not in the mere possession of money. It lies in the joy of achievement, in the thrill of creative effort, the joy, the moral stimulation of work, no longer must be forgotten in the mad chase of evanescent profit.
These dark days, my friends, will be worth all they cost us.
If they teach us that our true destiny is not to be ministered unto, but to minister to ourselves, to our fellow men.
Roosevelt said that the most important need was to put people back to work. And he said the federal government would have to take an active part in creating jobs. Roosevelt said there were many ways to help the nation recover. But, he said, it would never be helped just by talking about it. We must act, he said, and act quickly.
Roosevelt had a strong and serious look on his face. He told the crowd that all the necessary action was possible under the American system of government. But he warned that Congress must cooperate with him to get the nation moving again. Then, his speech finished, Roosevelt waved to the crowd and smiled. Herbert Hoover shook his hand and left. Roosevelt rode alone through the huge crowds back to the White House. And he immediately began a series of conferences.
Roosevelt's inauguration speech of 1933 was one of the most powerful and important speeches in American history. Roosevelt's speech was like an ocean wave that washes away one period of history and brings in a new one. The president seemed strong. He gave people hope. The new president promised the American people action. And action came quickly. During the next 3 months, Roosevelt and the Democrats would pass more major new programs than the nation had seen in many years. We look at this beginning of the Roosevelt administration in our next program.
Gone are my blues and gone are my tears. I've got good news to shout in your ears. The long-lost dollar has come back to the fold. With silver you can turn your dreams to gold. Oh, we're in the money.
Our program was written by David Jarmel. With Shirley Griffith, I'm Steve Ember. You can find our series online with pictures, transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.
Oh, man, you, we never see a headline about red light.